You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings, and I'd like to welcome you to this forum on health information exchanges and policy mega change. And for those of you who are interested in tweeting, we have set up a Twitter hashtag at TechCTI. That's TechCDI, so you can feel free to make comments or pose questions during the course of the actual event. As we all know, healthcare poses many challenges in the United States in terms of quality, access, affordability, and data integration. It is an example of policy mega change because it involves large-scale policymaking that gets into complex political issues, complicated organizational dynamics, and major policy challenges. One of the latest efforts to address various aspects of healthcare are health information exchanges. Health information exchanges are designed to share data, enhance communications, integrate health provider networks, and promote quality healthcare, among other objectives. Today, Alan Friedman and I are releasing a study of health information exchange implementation. As part of our research, we looked at how states are, or what states are doing in terms of implementing health information exchanges. We reviewed strategy documents submitted to the Office of National Coordinator, conducted interviews, and gathered data and information on progress and barriers to success. There are copies of the paper outside if you did not pick up one on the way in. It's also available on the Brookings website at brookings.edu. We also want to acknowledge the assistance of several people at the MITRE Corporation, which is a nonprofit organization that manages federally funded research and development centers. And that includes John Pisey, Rob Creekmore, Joy Keeler-Tobin, and Lisa Tutterow. They all helped with the research and offered comments on various stages of the paper. I'll just quickly summarize some of our main findings. I won't get too much into the details since you have a copy of the paper in front of you. But basically what we found is that health information exchanges have made progress in establishing organizational frameworks, building technology-based connections, and bringing relevant groups to the table for discussion of all of the complicated issues involved in those types of exchanges. However, we also found that barriers remain in terms of governance, financing, and policy vision. Some states have experienced difficulties in producing consensus on strategies and approaches, and also in identifying consistent revenue streams. So in the paper, we go through several different states in detail, look exactly what their experiences are, what progress they have made, what challenges they've overcome, how they're seeking to overcome some of those challenges, and then we close the paper by making some recommendations on steps that we think would help promote implementation in the future. To help us analyze the issues surrounding health information exchange implementation, we have brought together a distinguished set of speakers. Janet Marsha Broda is chair of the Health Information Technology Initiative of the Health Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. She also served as the founding chief executive officer for eHealth Initiative, a nonprofit designed to improve healthcare quality and efficiency through information technology. John Pisek is strategy and engagement leader at the Center for Transforming Health at MITRE. He has over 30 years of technology and management consulting experience and has particular expertise in coordinating large-scale cross-agency change. John White is director of health IT and acting director of the Center for Primary Care Prevention and Clinical Partnerships at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. He was trained as a family medicine doctor, and at the agency, he leads a group of individuals who work on the use of health IT to improve healthcare quality. Claudia Williams is director of State Health Information Exchange at the Office of National Coordinator of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She leads ONC's efforts to enable health information exchange to support provider achievement of meaningful use and sustainable improvements in healthcare quality and efficiency. She came to ONC from the Markle Foundation, where she was director of health policy and public affairs. The format that we're going to follow today is I've asked each panelist to make a brief opening statement regarding their views about some of the issues in this area. So we're going to start with Claudia Williams. She's going to review some of the ONC goals and the general framework that ONC has been following. Claudia.
So this is one of those good news, bad news days. The good news is, the bad news first is I forgot my pumps, but the good news is this is not webcast, so, so you can enjoy my purple shoes. It's a great delight to be here today with this distinguished panel, and I'm going to talk about exchange and our goals for exchange at ONC, touching on the role of the state program, but really speaking broadly about where we are, where we need to go, and how we're going to see exchange really take off this year. So just to start with, what is our goal? Our goal is to get information moving to support patient care in a secure way. Our goal is not necessarily to support a particular model, a particular approach, but really to see the percentage of transitions that are supported by the information that's needed, of lab results going to doctors electronically, of patients able to get their own information. We need to see these measures really take off. So that's a critical thing to think about. If our goal is to advance exchange as a verb, what should the approach and strategy be? I think historically we've thought about whether there's a RIA, whether there's an exchange organization in every market, but increasingly our thinking is evolving to realize there are multiple formats, there are multiple mechanisms, there are multiple organizations advancing exchange, but how can we really see it take off? So where are we today? Well, we're not in great shape. So even the most basic care coordination tasks, like getting a discharge summary when your patient is discharged, which is critically important to improve care and reduce readmissions, we see that about a quarter of the time that occurs within 2 days, and almost never electronically. We see that about 19% of hospitals have a mechanism to share clinical information outside their own system. So we are starting at a fairly low bar, and we have a lot of improvement to make. In addition, there are pockets of what we think of as RIO-based exchange across the nation. Some of the most famous examples would be IHI, which is highlighted in the paper, the Memphis system also highlighted in the paper, and these are often providing multiple kinds of exchange to folks living in those communities. So we want to see exchange take off this year. Now, if you look at things like e-prescribing, we have seen a doubling in e-prescribing this year, just in 1 year, literally a doubling. And we want to see that same kind of hockey stick progression, especially for the core care coordination tasks, which are going to be necessary to supply information for payment reforms. So if you remember, those of you who have been part of our tribe of meaningful use, there's a famous swoosh. Somebody said to me, I can't look at that swoosh anymore without thinking of meaningful use. But it described a progression. David Blumenthal used to call it an escalator, where we start with getting folks on board. We start with getting information digital. In stage two, we move to increasingly robust requirements around moving information, exchanging information. And as we move out even further, we look much more closely at quality of care, quality measurement, and performance feedback. So I don't have the visual, but if you imagine that swoosh, we are poised at the doorstep of stage two now. We expect that rule will be released within the next month or so. So as we move into this middle phase where our expectations through meaningful use and through other things are for exchange, how do we think about the tools and levers we have to affect that? Now, if you think of exchange as a kind of scale with cost on one side and value on the other and trust supporting it, really that value proposition isn't coming from health IT. It's not coming even, except to a certain extent, from meaningful use. It's coming from our changed expectations of what we want from the healthcare system. So in a healthcare system that pays for volume and not quality, it's very rational not to see a lot of exchange occurring. It's obviously not what we want. It's not what's in the patient's interest. But there's not a strong business case under that model. But as we see payment reforms, whether through the ACA or through state efforts or through private efforts, really burgeoning this year, we're seeing a great increase in interest and a great increased focus on exchange and really the value cases there. So ONC's role is not to create a value case. That is being created by the transformation that's occurring within our healthcare delivery system and payment reforms. But our job is to decrease the cost and increase the trust. So let's talk about that a little bit. One of the core responsibilities we really have is to drive adoption of national standards that can solve core problems of exchange, core problems of interoperability. So how are we doing? You know, people who are in the trenches, I talked yesterday to a CIO at a hospital. He was like, listen, this stuff is tough. Every interface takes a month. It takes $25,000. They're not standards to support it. Well, let's look at meaningful use for a minute. So we now have standardized ways to report medications. We have standardized ways to record information. We use vocabularies and content standards for all the information in every single certified EHR. So the challenge of me giving you a piece of information and you understanding it and being able to incorporate it into your EHR, that's really going to be driven by the standards, the content standards that were part of Stage 1 Meaningful Use. Okay, so you can understand something I send you, but can I send it to you? So we need standardized ways to accomplish the sending and receiving of information. And we have two national standards that are in use and that are being used today to do that. So we need to unpack the conversation. We need to drive towards these national standards, but sometimes the real issue is the business model. So business models that gain value from retaining and capturing and not sharing information, there's always going to be a reason not to reduce costs. There's always going to be a reason not to adopt standards. So we need to have an open conversation about the business models, the models that are rewarding the sharing privately and securely of information to improve patient care, and the cases where, frankly, it's not in people's interest, and we need to encourage a change in the underlying business strategy pursued by that organization. So as cost goes down, as value goes up, we're going to start to see information really flow, going from a trickle to a flow to a flood. Now, it can only move as fast as we develop trust. And today, often the trust relationships that are needed for exchange are negotiated one by one by one between organizations who sign business agreements. And that's not a scalable approach. So this year, we will be taking forward a set of governance policies through a regulation that we hope would describe a way to have a common set of interoperability and trust requirements that, again, may make exchange scalable by decreasing the cost and burden of all of those one-on-one negotiations. So now let's turn to the question of the State Health Information Exchange Program, which has funded every state and territory across the nation to make rapid progress in enabling exchange this year to support meaningful use. So I think when this program was first funded, there was a conception of what this would look like. What this would look like in people's view was a statewide public utility that everybody was using, that made started with really, in some ways, the hardest use case, which is finding information, querying information, and would be available for everybody to use. But I think as we've seen the marketplace evolving, as we've seen exchange evolving, and as states started to look at the $5 million they had compared to the perhaps $1 million every single hospital was investing exchange, I think the conception and the evolution of thinking about the role of this program has really evolved. It wasn't enough money. There wasn't enough buy-in. That wasn't the model that people really supported. And instead, what we're seeing is really smart uses of these resources to knit together existing exchange organizations, like in Indiana, to provide shared services like directories and ID services that could reduce the cost for everybody, to invest in emerging and nascent exchange efforts like in California, and in some cases, like in the case of Delaware or Maryland, to provide a public utility exchange. So we expect these dollars to be spent to reduce the cost of exchange, to fill gaps, especially for the lowest resource providers, and also to assure trust in the state. We expect these resources to leverage private investments, not compete with them. And we also expect that a key role of the state is to use the broad range of policy levers at their disposal, from payment policies to regulations, to advance the idea that care will not be delivered without the critical information being there to support it. So I'm sorry to have gone over the 5 minutes, but thank you very much for the opportunity.
Actually, that was very interesting, so it's perfectly fine for you to have taken the time. John Pisak, you originated this concept of policy mega change, and certainly in the healthcare area, we know there are tons of different types of complications. There are policy changes that cross agency boundaries that involve both public and private and nonprofit organizations and lots of different stakeholders in the process. So can you just tell us a little bit about the broader concept of mega change and how it plays out in healthcare?
Sure. Well, I guess it started in a weird way in that I was working on a review of a four-agency cooperative program called the National Disaster Medical System. So it's a partnership of VA and DOD, DHS, and HHS. And I started looking for literature on large-scale organizational change across organizational boundaries. I didn't find much. And part of that may be that I couldn't figure out the right search terms because how do you characterize that? Okay, so we ended up coining the term mega change to describe this kind of change where there are independent actors involved in and you're pushing on string, as it were, and how do you address those problems? And I took a look at 22 different large-scale federal change programs and tried to isolate some of the factors that made for success or failure. And I was somewhat surprised. A lot of factors I thought would be crucial kind of dropped out, you know, some of them about management style, and some of them about leadership, and some of them about the impetus for the program. But others you know, did seem to present sort of this core of things that you had to address in organizational, interorganizational change management to succeed in these kinds of programs. And so we had an initial cut at about 8 factors and a kind of spider chart that we used on a couple of projects. And because we are operate federally funded R&D centers, we applied the methodology with a couple of our sponsors. And the problem we have is you have the sort of seal of the confessional. You know, they're telling you all the flaws in their program, and you're seeing them all, and then you can't publish or talk about it. And that led us to come to Brookings and say, hey, we think this has some merit as a way to take a snapshot of where you are in your program, and it's kind of a survey tool, which led to the conversations we had with Daryl about, hey, but, you know, could you guys apply this, and what would be a great topic? Now, as it worked out, and we had I'd worked on a panel before with Daryl at HIMSS on digital health when he published that book. And, I'm in the Center for Transforming Health at MITRE. And I think it was Alan Friedman who first said, hey, why don't we look at something where a bunch of people are doing the same thing in parallel? And the state HIE program was a great laboratory to kind of apply this technique. So, I have to say, looking at the paper now, I think I feel like Antonio Stradivari might have felt if he had gone up to Brandenburg in 1721 and seen a couple of his, you know, brand new violins being played in the Brandenburg Concerti, because, you know, we have some master musicians. You know, I was going to say I felt like, you know, Zacharias Hildebrandt, and people would go, who?
Yeah.
But he was the guy who built the harpsichords that Bach played every week at the coffee house in Leipzig. But anyway, that feeling of, hey, that's my instrument they played. And I think if you read the paper and you look on page 36, there's sort of this summary diagram, and you can say, look, there's hope here for sure, because look at where Indiana and Massachusetts have gotten to, right? And how did they do it? And a lot of that was getting fundamental agreement, getting the stakeholders into alignment. It's the blocking and tackling on all these fronts that the mega change profiler addresses. And for anyone who's interested afterwards, if you want, we have copies of the tool. It's free. You know, there's a how-to guide. Any analyst who wants to use it to analyze this kind of change, I'd encourage you to get in touch with me or with Rob Creekmore, my colleague here, and we're happy to make it available. Again, I've used it about 5 times in different settings with very illuminating results. In some cases, you know, we just said, look, that program will not work under any circumstances because there's a flaw in the design. So, that sort of, I'm very pleased to see this has happened. What I would encourage people to do if you find a paper of value in the way you think about health information exchange or about other multi-state programs or public-private sector partnership programs, think about doing it yourselves. It takes a couple hours to figure this stuff out and do an assessment. It's not an overly elaborate process, but it's a very helpful sort of diagnostic tool. And it's not a Swiss Army knife. It doesn't solve all your problems. We have suggestions on some of the kinds of policies that help you correct some of the issues that come up. And you can't really change, usually, the external environment or the organizational environment. They're just facts. You just have to deal with them. But we certainly hope that people will take this instrument and play some new tunes with it, and I invite anyone who wants to try that.
Okay. Thank you, John. Janet, you've had a long career thinking about health IT and information exchanges, so I'm just curious if you could give us your thoughts on where you think the country needs to go, what the barriers we are encountering, and strategies to deal with them.
Well, thank you, Daryl. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I applaud the Center's release of a report on health information exchange. It could not be more important, particularly now. We're at an important time in healthcare. Back on January 27th, the Bipartisan Policy Center, in particular a task force, led by Senators Daschle and Frist and comprised of a number of nationally recognized experts, took a look at what do we need as a country to achieve the triple aim, better care, better health care, reduced costs. And we went through interviews with about 40 high-performing organizations, had a lot of dialogue, did a lot of research, and what we found was a number of things, but we need to move towards more accountable, coordinated, patient-centered models of care, new ways of delivering care, new methods of payment. And you know what? We can't get there. Those health information exchange is foundational and critical to get to those new models of care. So we've got to get there as a country. We explored a number of the barriers, and I'll talk about that over the next couple of minutes. Claudia talked about the biggest one, and it's really around alignment of incentives, and she said it. Right now, we reward doing more volume as opposed to quality and cost outcomes, and so it makes no sense for a hospital or physician from a business standpoint to check to see whether a lab test result has already been done or an MRI to check results. One just does one over. So we've got to tackle that first, and that's probably the biggest thing, and we're really encouraged with the work that's happening with private sector health plans across the country who are experimenting with this at the local and national level, as well as CMMI. The second thing, we think, and when we've talked with folks, we need to get a little bit further on standards, whether they're data transport standards or data content standards, more easy to use guides in order to apply those standards, so you don't have to be a big integrated delivery system in order to make those standards work. So we need more work there. And I'll tell you, if you look at what's happened, and necessarily so, the first set of adopted standards that came out as part of HITECH really focused on what we need for meaningful use. We would love to see it go beyond that because there are many organizations that are building accountable care organizations today or patient-centered medical homes that want to exchange data that sort of goes beyond what might be required by government. So long-term data strategy with standards. Privacy and security still is an issue, but less so. I mean, I think the numbers are coming down. And from what folks tell us, more clarity around policy, not necessarily more, but maybe more clarity and education around what they need. I think there's still a lot of confusion out there. And again, think about those small physician practices that don't have huge compliance staff or lawyers to help them figure this out. And then finally, and this is part of, I think, your model around mega change, consensus on path forward. And I'll tell you, Daryl was saying I've been at this a long time, looking at what's happening. And I think it was too early before. And if you look at the federal government's appropriate portfolio approach on looking at what works and not, if their decisions had been made 2 years ago, it would have been too soon. But now we've got a lot of lessons. We've got a business case on the horizon with payment reform and delivery system reform. And for the first time, talking with a whole host of folks that maybe weren't there 2 years ago, whether it's providers, physician practices, hospitals, labs, vendors, I see an appetite for coming to agreement around a set of policies, standards. We'd have to talk about how far down you go, but principles and policies for getting to exchange, even on a voluntary basis, that could be something that could inform what the federal government adopts over the long term. So that's my 4 minutes on where we are, barriers, challenges, and some things that we'll need to get there.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. John White, you work on healthcare research and quality. Your agency has made some initial investments of this going back over a number of years. You think people and processes are an important part of the implementation challenges. So could you tell us a little bit about your perspective on this?
Sure. So in the beginning, there was quality. And it's at the foundation of what we do at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. There's pretty broad consensus amongst us all that we think high-quality healthcare is good and that we ought to be striving for that. And we recognize that there are some issues with our system now and how we get there. So when you take a look at what quality means and you start to kind of break it down, you say, well, what do you need to do to be able to improve quality? Broad consensus that you need to be able to exchange information. Okay, different people need to have different information at different times in different ways to make this work. So we recognized a long time ago that this was fairly important. Now, ARC, which is the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, our role in the federal family is to help build the evidence for what works and what doesn't work in improving healthcare in this country. And we do that in a bunch of different ways. We fund research, we fund demonstrations, and going back 8 years now, long time, we started looking at health information exchange and said, well, so how do you do that? So we funded a number of demonstrations in a number of different states. You've heard about some of them here. Indiana's been mentioned. Memphis, the Mid-South eHealth Alliance has been mentioned. Delaware has been mentioned. These are states that ARC made initial investments in starting 8 years ago. And they had several years to work on this. At that time, there was not a legislative mandate to start moving ahead with health information exchange. Everybody said this is important, but we said we don't quite know how we do this. So that's what ARC does, is we help build the evidence on how you do this. As you'll read in the paper, what we found is that, you know, this is a little harder than we thought it was going to be. It's kind of like having kids, right? I love my kids. My kids are very important, you know, and I would never say that, you know, well, we should just throw the kids out because they're hard to deal with, right? But it's harder than we thought. It's not just about servers, and it's not just about software and standards. It's about people, and it's about people cooperating. Really, when we dug into it, we found that it was as much about a function of high cooperation as it was high organization and high capabilities. And again, Daryl's done an excellent, and his colleagues have done an excellent job in outlining that in the paper, so I'll let you read that. We think it's still important. We still think we need to have it driven forward. We're glad that we were able to make initial investments and that ONC was able to kind of take those and run with them. The different states that we funded years ago have served as models for different ways of how to do this, and I hope you feel like folks have learned from what they've done. And as we move ahead, you mentioned tools and levers that we might have at our disposal. Now that we've got it functioning, now let's start thinking about quality. That's good. It's good that it's working. But what does it mean that, you know, we suffer less or we live longer or that we get better value for our dollar? And how do we use these tools? What are the best ways to use these tools to get to those ends? And that's, again, something that ARC does, helps build the evidence. So we're looking forward to continuing to work with all of you as we move ahead with that.
Okay, why don't I throw out a question for everyone on the panel, and each of you can jump in as you would like. Claudia started with several interesting points, and it was kind of a good news, bad news scenario, not just in terms of your shoes, but in terms of health information exchanges, because you pointed out that today you said we're not in great shape, but then looking forward over the next year, you're expecting the exchanges to really take off. And in our paper, we identified a number of challenges in terms of the business model, the revenue streams, aligning incentives, consensus on the path forward. John is mentioning the need for cooperation. So for each of you, if you could just think about the year going forward, what is it that we can do that will make exchanges take off so that we can actually achieve some of the benefits that we're all looking for? Anyone? Jenna?
Well, I think the first thing is, I mean, there's a lot of progress being made out there amongst private sector payers around testing new payment and delivery system reforms. Doing that and doing that more, continued and sustained funding for CMMI because, you know, operationalizing some of those changes doesn't require legislative action. And something I didn't talk about in my 4 minutes, we've got a great opportunity with stage two of meaningful use. And, you know, the field wasn't ready with stage one. If you look at the requirements, they're pretty meager. You know, you have to do one test of exchange. It could be with fictional patients. And then there's another menu option. But let's go further. This is a terrific opportunity to use that incentive program to go further on exchange. This is just some ideas in the coming year.
Okay. Others? Claudia?
So I think a lot's already been discussed that addresses that. But I think one thing we're starting to see is real dirt in the fingernails approaches to saying, okay, how should we be using this capacity? So one of the things we've seen in communities that have made vast investments in the capacity is they still don't really know how to drive adoption of it. So if you have the capacity to look up a patient record, when should you do that? And what should you be looking for, and how do you use that information? Should you not do another radiology test if you see one's already been done? So that's one. When you refer a patient, exactly how should you send along the information? What notes should you make about how to use the information? Who's working on the workflow and the processes and integrating into the EHR? So if we really want to see adoption take off of exchange, we're going to have a much more granular conversation about the exact clinical cases where you should be using exchange, what the results you should expect would be in terms of reduced testing or reduced medication errors, and how do we bring that workflow all the way down to where the doc is working on his or her EHR. This is obviously not something that we can overnight snap our fingers and say, here's what it is. It's going to involve EHR vendors working on it. It's going to involve payment initiatives describing what their expectations are. It's going to involve usability around HIE. It's going to involve evidence around what's working. But I think we have to take the conversation to the next layer of sort of granularity around exactly what are we talking about? How should this be used, and what outcomes do we expect? And how can we almost script out a set of workflow steps for a doc who wants to be able to send information electronically to patients and to other doctors?
So
I think, yes, incentives are crucial. And one part of the incentives will be if the bundled payment initiative that CMS has underway to create ACOs work out. If that begins to be adopted, there'll be a lot of incentive for coordination of care, oftentimes across organizations or among virtual organizations. So I think incentives are going to be really important. And I think in our model, we talk about willingness to contribute as a really crucial area, and where you can't have, you know, where you're not going to get voluntary cooperation. You have to be willing to pay for things, right? Mm-hmm. And two models could happen. One is that you could reimburse for the actual exchange, you know, which is could be built into the medical care reimbursement cost in Medicare Part A and Part B. Or you could say, okay, if you can use these tools to improve quality, reduce costs, reduce readmissions, go for it. That'll create a demand pull for that kind of service. So either of those approaches can work. If we try to over-engineer the use cases and everything, we'll just delay the onset of it. It really has to do with, you know, where's the money in a lot of cases. So I think that's important. I do want to mention, because it came up, that I think ONC has been one of the much better than most organizations at reaching out to stakeholders, getting feedback, and adapting. I mean, it was to the point at one point, one of my friends, Omid Mogadon from Intel, was saying, yeah, they went from a strategy of, okay, let's build a network and no phones, to let's buy the phones and no network. And now they've, but now they've got the, you know, the right mixed approach to adoption, to HIE formation going. I think it's a balanced program, and they're looking at all the indications and trying to make things happen. I think it's hard. You are pushing on string anytime you're doing a mega change. The one other thing that we really have to work out, and I think this is going to take more work, both technically and on a policy level, is the trust element, right? You know, we have all these people who will have EHRs. It's sort of like getting all dressed up for the prom, but you don't have a date. You know, you don't, who are you going to exchange with if you don't trust anybody, you know?
That's right.
So it's a problem that we have to solve. We have to have a scalable foundation for trust. There are a number of projects that have being done around this, and you know, Claudia's colleague Joy Pritz, and there's a team at ONC working on privacy. It's got to be tackled in a big way. I think the whether the state is the right unit for trust or some smaller segments, whether it's federated or not, you know, how do you do that? There's a bunch of issues there to still work through. They shouldn't be allowed to delay. If the market's demanding action, then people will take the risk of trusting more because it becomes a business risk, like with credit cards or anything else, right? You're just going to say, okay. But right now, there's a sort of draconian HIPAA compliance thing and no offsetting benefits. And so you're going to say, okay, why take the chance, right? And so between incentives and building a trust framework, we can overcome that issue.
Bill, these are great points. The only thing that I would add is that there are a couple of organizations, locations, around our country that are doing a reasonably good job with health information exchange. And not just because they're exchanging the health information, but they're changing the care that they deliver, and it's getting better because of it. I really think in the next year, which is your question, those folks need to stand up and they need to show the rest of us what they're doing and how they're doing it and why it's so good. Because what then needs to pull behind that is the rest of us need to say, well, how come I'm not getting that? And how come my system isn't going there? Or how come we're not participating in that? Or we need to participate in that? And I think that's going to provide that drive that you asked about and say, well, why aren't we all kind of getting there? I think once folks show that the care is changing and people are getting better care because of it, that'll pull us ahead.
Yes. Claudia.
I have one more. I know it's something that everyone probably in this panel has thought about, and it was figured prominently in the BPC report, but it's time we bring patients into the conversation about exchange.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yesterday I was on a panel in Maryland with a family practice physician who had initiated a consumer portal. She was the first in her practice to do so. Her colleagues were a little wanting to wait and see how this worked. And she had a patient who, with multiple chronic problems, who simply, she hadn't figured out the way to help him. And she said, let's try security mail. Let's see if that works. And he started sending her messages every night. Now, she said he didn't expect a response, but he would say, you know, I've been thinking about what you asked. And the kind of engagement that we see in every sector of life, using the tools that we have, we are not going to get to the changes and improvements we want if we can't figure out a way to leverage it. It brings its own set of challenges, not least of which are what is the workflow, again, for a doc and showing information for the patient, or what are the privacy issues. But we simply will not get to our healthcare goals if we don't tackle this front on. There are some very promising policy movements. For instance, there's an NPRM out on sharing lab data directly with patients with a delay that allows the doc to inform the patient ahead of time. But we need to make it easier, again, easier and cheaper and more automatic for patients to be able to get their own information, because we're simply not going to be able to achieve these goals we want without it.
Just, and I know we're something that we wanted to pursue but didn't have the time within the report was consumer-mediated exchange. And many folks think if we can't get there, you know, across providers and laboratories and the like, you know, what if we had an easier time? And exchange plays a key role there. If I can download and pull my information, not so convenient that I need to take it to my doctor over here or the hospital over here, but that might apply some further pressure on the system. And there are a number of folks that think that that might be the answer in the long term. So something, area of research and piloting, I think.
Okay, speaking of bringing the patients in, we would like to bring the audience into this discussion. So let's open the floor to questions and comments. You have, we have microphones that will be coming up. We have a question right here on the aisle. If you could give us your name and if you have an organizational affiliation as well. And also, we'd ask you to keep your questions brief just so we can get to as many of you as possible.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and I'm a Kaiser. I belong to Kaiser, and the information exchange there is really terrific. I get my test results. I have the test in the morning, look in the computer afternoon. I don't understand why there isn't greater adoption of this. Although I did notice one problem. I'm enrolled here. I needed services in Cleveland, and turns out even among the Kaiser, they can't transfer the information from their
region to region
to the Midwest. So there's that's a problem. But greater adoption of health maintenance organizations would go a long way.
Okay, we have a question right here.
Hi, I'm Allison Percy from the Congressional Budget Office. You talked about trust, and I want to find out what you mean by trust. Is it just privacy and security, or are we talking about different, possibly competing businesses trusting what's going to be done with the information? And how does that build into the business case that you've been talking about?
So it really involves both, I would say. So at a fundamental level, patient information is private and protected by law. And so that creates obligations on the part of anybody who's going to send it to anyone else to make sure that that patient was consented to the use of that under HIPAA. But the business case questions are also very interesting, right? As we, you will see providers who will begin to say, well, it's a competitive advantage for me that I can do this. So I think that ownership rights of medical information, it's got to be clearly expressed at some level that the patient owns those records. Now, one method is to move to the consumer model. I think we're a little ways off from that.
Yeah.
You know, Google just sort of gave up the ghost on their attempt. You know, Microsoft's had sort of limited uptake. Probably many people in this room have tried one or both of those and quit because it was too hard to use. So we've got a ways to go on that to make the consumer pull happen, which would overcome the competitive business resistance. I think healthcare, more than a lot of industries, is pretty is more public-spirited, but not to the point of saying, yeah, I'll tell you all about my patient, and then they won't come back, and that'll be the end of that. I think there is some of that, too. There's foot-dragging beyond, and I guess I think the incentives have to really be there. You have to get paid to support that that exchange of information, not just to provide the care. Or it has to be incidental to providing the care, but compensated for. So,
Claudia,
it's a tough problem.
Since you mentioned the issue of trust, do you have a sense of what we can do to build trust, especially across businesses?
I actually want to go to this business case issue for a minute. So yesterday, we were having a conversation with a national vendor who has been really, I think, a leader in solutions that deliver value to users. We were kind of talking about, well, could there be a model where what you're really competing over is making it super easy for your docs to exchange information to support patient care? So maybe if you have a provider directory, you open that up to other people so they could find your docs. Maybe you use national standards to make it easier and cheaper for other folks to connect. And it was interesting. They were very open, but there was sort of a pause, and they were like, huh, we haven't really thought about competing like that. That's not the way we've thought about what our competitive advantage is. So I think part of what we're hopefully going to see is a new type of competition based on competing on making information available that's needed. Now, obviously, you can't, if this one vendor did it and nobody else did, it wouldn't have much of an effect. But let's say a third of the marketplace did this and maybe tried to think about how it would look like to compete, not over capturing and retaining and not sharing information, but based on securely sharing information to support what the patient wants and what the provider wants. So I hope to see new kinds of competitive spirit And these are marketplaces. So over time, you would hope that those businesses rewarded by a marketplace of users and by a payment system that's pushing in the right direction start to gain traction, and that those that aren't lose traction. So there's another term for the mega change, which is ultra-large-scale system that's been described to how do big systems develop? And I think we see these sort of like incremental changes moving the direction of what people are competing over and what they trust over. But we all know that this is not an easy change that will occur overnight. But I think we have to think in terms of what kinds of rewards are we giving, not just to providers, but also to vendors for the behaviors that are going to support this. And how can we better, through our purchasing decisions and our business decisions, support those that are delivering value? So I don't know if that answered your question. But
it did. Right there is another question.
Hi, thank you. I'm Joel Slackman with the Cross Blue Shield Association. Terrific conversation. I wanted to follow up on CBO's question in the discussion you've just had. The last several years have seen an acceleration of provider consolidation, hospitals buying up physician practices, hospitals merging, and so on. And all other things being equal, a consolidated health system does not want to share information for competitive reasons. My question is, when we look at places around the country where exchange is working, like Indiana, like Memphis, could you give us some concrete examples of what those places did to overcome this natural tendency among consolidated systems not to want to share information?
I mean, what we found in some of our interviews in those places is cooperation takes place when each of the stakeholders see it as in their own self-interest to do so. So certainly in the case of Indiana, they had an advantage of they kind of got into this data sharing very early, and so there was kind of a history. You build up the relationships over time. That creates the trust. And so kind of all of those ingredients we found were important.
So when you start talking about digital data, okay, this whole ownership of data gets kind of funky. It's a model that we have ingrained in our head, right? But it gets a little funky because you can replicate that data as many times as you want and, you know, send it all over the place. For, I don't know, five-ish years, we've been talking about stewardship of data as opposed to ownership of data. And working with the folks in Indiana and the folks in Memphis, for example, they saw themselves as stewards of the data, that there was, you know, a purpose that was being served by that data, okay, and it wasn't necessarily for them, okay, but it was maybe it was a shared resource, maybe it was in the interest of the patient. It varies a little bit from place to place. Another way for folks to address these competitive issues is to try to find a common pain point. In Memphis, they did it around emergency room visits, okay? And they said, you know, this is a place where we clearly have an issue. Everybody's feeling pain about this. People come to the emergency department. We don't have information about them. Let's try to address that. And it grew from there. They've grown and they've been able to go beyond that, but they found a common pain point that they started at. So
I would just spend a lot of time looking at Indiana over the last 5 or 6 years. And what was compelling for me is recognizing the power of the market. Mm-hmm. If you look at the folks that started the Indiana efforts out there, the employers were at the table, the hospital CEOs, the physicians, and the health plans, they've had involvement of everyone. But it wasn't just getting people to come together to agree, to sing kumbaya and agree on doing something. Actually, everyone got something out of it, whether it was the Blues plan or the national plan in Indianapolis through Quality Health First. They were able to see how their physicians were doing and change payment as a result. For the hospital CEOs, they actually saw reductions in cost, considerable reductions in cost, and so it made business sense, and then the physicians also. So very much a market-based approach, looking at recognizing that actors have interests and to deliver a service that actually provides value for which folks are willing to pay, I think really set them apart from some others.
And just one quick footnote to that. I mean, we certainly found that governance was actually crucial to building those relationships. Like if you have the institutional processes of consultation and relationship building, that is a huge advantage in terms of actually helping to produce a broader consensus over goals, tactics, and strategies.
Can I just add? There's a funny underlying thing, too, around sequencing. And so in Indiana, and I think it's talked about in the paper, they started with electronically delivering results and then moved to query, then moved to quality. Now, I don't think in every case that's going to be the progression, but I think what it speaks to is biting off something that delivers value immediately. Mm-hmm. So in Memphis, they restricted the use of the exchange initially just to ER docs and just to the clinical use cases within that ER. Now, obviously, that's not where they want to get eventually, but it allows folks to understand that particular thing, to develop the policies appropriate for it, and not try to design one solution that can do 100 things, because you just get mired in complexity and mired in difficulty. So the challenge is how to build increasingly complex and interesting and resource-rich exchange, but do it in a way that allows you to show real progress along the way, rather than say 5 years from now we're going to have this thing that's going to deliver value. Because I don't think that's the path that most successful exchange has taken.
Okay, you know, there's a funny thing about Memphis. It's funny that you said it that way, that they restricted ER docs. As we funded them and the years went by, when I first knew it was showing value was when they said, you know, yeah, we're keeping this in the ER docs, but it turns out the inpatient docs are sneaking downstairs and, like, printing out stuff and taking it back up to the floor because that was the only way they could get the information. And it's like, okay, all right, when you've got a workaround to get at your health IT, suddenly you're creating value for people. So.
You know, it's funny. 20 years ago or so, I wrote a paper in AHIMA, at the EMEA Journal, I guess it was, and the Journal of AHIMA, actually, and it was on the Health Information Management Department as a source of competitive advantage. And so I appreciate the question enormously. But on further reflection, I really think that if you were to go around and really ask patients, okay, why do you go to your doctor and what would keep you from switching, you know, where your health record is probably way down the list, actually. It's that they know you, you know them, you know, there's sort of relationship factors. I don't know where the record, I think that business people probably overstate the importance of that as one of the factors in where people go for care. It is probably a factor, but not near the top of the list. So part of it would be really seeing what happens, and I think maybe what happened with Indianapolis was they got their toes in the water, and then nothing bad happened, and then they got their ankle in and so forth. But it had to be, there was probably that whole resistance, and it takes time to overcome that.
Okay, here in the front row, did you have a question? No. Okay, then right back there.
Good morning. Will Lang with the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy. I'm going to change this from the business model to the education model. Mm-hmm. And wondering how any one of your groups or anybody has come to the health professions education community and saying there has to be a fundamental change about the way that we educate physicians and pharmacists and nurses because of HIE's expectations that you're going to have different ways of engaging with patient communication, data analysis, all the kind of things you've mentioned today. Is anybody talking to us?
OMC has a great workforce training program.
Yeah. You know, I wish I was the person that knew all the things we're doing because I know we're doing a lot in this area. I think the workforce issue, it's interesting. One of the things that's true is almost every doc trains in the VA. And in the course of their residency or their training. And so everyone's being exposed to the potential that we have here. I think there are a lot of workforce and graduate medical education challenges that focus on adoption, that focus on how do you do quality feedback within a practice, that focus on the care management skills of planned care for chronic patients. So my hope would be that we can situate exchange not as a separate thing, but as a key tool to accomplish these other things that are needed to deliver on the triple aim. So our workforce efforts at ONC have focused on graduate education as well as community college education to train the HIT workforce. But I think what you're raising is a separate question of how do we engage and prepare physicians and other medical professionals to deliver care using health IT.
So I'll just quickly mention, so ARC has actually a great resource called WebMNM, and every month it's a couple cases that are posted, and being a doctor, I know about the doctor side of it, so you can get CME for it. I think you can also get nursing credits, pharmacy credits for different things that we have. But at least one of the cases over the past several years a month has been about health IT. It's also about patient safety and care management and stuff like that. But that's the kind of resource that you need. Now, that's a graduate approach, right? That's not getting, you know, in at the ground level. That's got to be done, too, though. So.
And Jenna?
I would just like to say you raise an excellent point. As Claudia had said, there are a number of workforce programs that focus on training health IT workers, where we've got a big shortage in our country right now and need to do more, and it's a great source of jobs. But I was down in Miami last week talking with the head of nursing, and you know, we don't, I wonder if there's a way to take the curriculum or the modules and infuse that into education for pharmacists and nurses and physicians. I don't think we're even close. This woman said, even my nurses, my students, if we could have a laboratory where they could play around with and use electronic health record systems, a range of them, not just one, and learn, you know, how it changes delivery of care. So I think there's a lot of work to do on the policy side and practice side.
Okay, we have a question right here.
One thing that this just makes me think about is payment for graduate medical education, at least at Medicare. I know that MedPAC and others are really talking about accountability measures and how those should be tied into how the federal government finances GME. So that's on the physician side, but I think that that's something to look at because MedPAC has recommended, implementing accountability measures that look at that say that programs need to address the changes in the workforce that are needed. So workforce development is really part of that. So I think looking at both the associations and the accreditation organizations for these providers is a really good place to look. And, of course, coordination with any federal efforts would be really critical. But I just know that's already on the table for GME, so it might be for other provider education programs as well.
Okay, thank you for that comment. Right behind you.
Let's not forget about names and organizations as we ask the question. I'm just curious.
If you could give us your names and organizations, that will help us.
I'm Paul Chapin with MedStar Health. We've participated in the D.C. HIE, and many of you know it was shut down last fall because the D.C. government decided to defund it. One of their arguments was that the ONC really wasn't pushing HIEs. They were really only pushing Project Direct, and that's where the meaningful use incentives are. How do we respond to them?
We had conversations with DC, and we said to them, listen, your investments, you need to pursue the strategies that make sense for you and for your city. We asked them to show us kind of the use rates and how that infrastructure could be used to meet the goals of our program, which are to support meaningful use by providers. And we said, you should make your decision based on whether this is the right infrastructure for you to get providers to be able to do the exchange requirements and meaningful use and for the program. So that they made a decision based on looking at their environment and looking at the capacity, looking at the current use, looking at the expense that they would face, and trying to figure out the best way forward for them to support the programmatic goals. But I will say it's a challenge. I think that Rio is an example of really great collaboration and investment. It was unclear what the use was of it, I think, and to what extent it was supporting patient care across the community. Those are the questions we asked or said, you know, look at how it's being used, look at the use cases, look at the adoption, look at the expense, and make the best decision for you that's going to rapidly enable the kind of capacity we need. So I think a lot of communities are asking those questions. What's the best way? I think one of the things you raised in the paper is places like in California, it's sometimes hard when you start out with a big government investment. That may not be – you need to make the investments and the things that are going to – people are going to be willing to pay for over time. And there's no way to end run that. You can't say, well, we invested $20 million this year, and the community is just going to have to pay for that next year. You have to look at, well, what is the community going to be willing to pay for? What can it pay for? How can we use payment incentives to do that? And how can we make it cheaper? So the question isn't, let's build this infrastructure, then figure out how to pay for it, but rather is, how do we build up a set of services that are innately sustainable over time because they're delivering value, they're mm-hmm. affordable, and they're what works to make care more coordinated. So it's a slightly different approach to thinking about sustainability, I think.
So, you know, the money discussion has its place in a discussion with folks that are supporting these sorts of things. But I mentioned this before. You need to come back to them and say, great, okay, you don't want to do this. I understand. So how are we going to get there? How are we going to get to better care in your community if we don't have health information exchange, if we're not able to share information back and forth? You know, they're the political leaders. Put that back on them and say, show us the way then. Tell if this is not it, what is it? And I would suspect that might spur the dialogue along.
You know, two things. One is, you know, D.C. is a great case of a place where, you know, unlike Indianapolis, which is smack in the middle of a big state, you know, D.C. is in the middle of sort of a tri-state area that has its a real need for information sharing across those boundaries. So drawing a line around the district may not be the right answer for D.C. So I'd say look at a regional solution, but also if look at the problem as an opportunity. Is there something MedStar could do? If there's a void, you know, is that an opportunity for MedStar or for somebody that you stimulate to get involved in solving that problem? If there's not a demand pull, well, then it's a problem. I was flashing back when Claudia was talking to telecom startups in the late 90s and early 2000s, right, where people just threw tons of money at infrastructure before they had customers. And, you know, what you saw with the slower building states, it started really with the original grants from ARC or even before that. They had time to work through the issues and build a scalable business model and build trust in everything, which hasn't happened. It does take time for some of this consensus to get forged and for some of these things to prove out in practice. And you've got to have this sort of startup mentality in this particular kind of case because you need to be sustainable.
Okay. Back there is a question. Yep.
Hi, Steve Redhead. That's CRS, Congressional Research Service. Money has a habit of driving behavior. And the big money...
I've noticed that in D.C.
And the big money right now, of course, is the Meaningful Use Incentive Program. $2.5 billion and counting, with the expectation, absent any change in the law this year, there'll be several more billion dollars in this calendar year. So it makes sense to hitch exchange to the meaningful use requirements. Of course, the law says that meaningful use has to include exchange, and the swoosh has, at stage two, a growing emphasis on exchange. Well, the HIT Policy Committee has made its recommendations for stage two, and I assume they will drive a good deal of the discussion and the outcome at CMS in the upcoming rule. So the question simply is, if all that's true, are the stage two recommendations adequate and sufficient? And I'll just add, I mean, we're obviously going to have already and this year an awful lot of providers around the country with these wonderful EHR systems, most of whom I assume are not connected to Indiana's exchange or the other exchanges around the country. But have got their EHR systems, getting their checks. Most of what they have to do right now only involves what goes on within their office, with the exception of electronic prescribing, which I think is a rather different case from everything we've been talking about. So anyway,
okay.
Particularly from Janet.
Obviously we are in the middle of rulemaking and we cannot comment on the contents, but let me say that relish your comments. So the minute these come out, we would love every form of debate and discussion, remembering that it's only the comments we actually receive that we can consider. And something to keep in mind is that we get a lot of comments about things people don't like, but remember to comment on the things you do like. Because if, you know, so I just want to use this as an invitation not to necessarily yet engage on this question, but to invite you to please engage with us in what you think about the rule, in what you think works and what you think doesn't work. And we take extremely seriously, CMS and NONC, the comments and thoughtful responses that you give when we put out rules.
Wait, I would just, and we've made it pretty clear in the report that we released, we think we need to go further on exchange. Much of the value that's derived from electronic health record adoption comes from the exchange of information. You have silos of information, so we need to go more quickly towards health information exchange. Systems to be able to, EHR technology to be able to receive, display, and transmit data using standards, and also for those transitions that Claudia talked about to be supported by exchange. And I think, unlike where we were a couple of years ago, I think we've got more time for implementation, and I think the market likes certainty and a long lead time in order to get ready. Remember, you know, again, alignment of incentives was a key component. And we also have all these wonderful reforms underway, whether delivery system or payment reform. And these hospitals and physician practices are going to need to exchange data, even if they don't go for meaningful use, and having some certainty around standards and infrastructure to enable the flow will be all the better.
So with money driving behavior, another thing to keep in mind is if the 27% cut in Part B Medicare reimbursements to physicians doesn't get fixed pretty soon, every day that doesn't happen, more hospitals are buying more physician practices. So you'll end up, because the reimbursements hospitals get for outpatient services are much higher than the ones that private practices get. So there's sort of an arbitrage opportunity that's created by these incentives right now that... So one of the answers from a adoption perspective is, well, that's good because the hospital systems adopt and they'll extend records to those hospitals, and maybe having a cottage industry isn't the right answer. On the other hand, other people say, well, I like a private doctor's office and I like that one-to-one attention and all that I feel I lose in a bigger system. So, but already consolidation is being driven by incentives, and consolidation will spur some level of adoption.
Okay, we have a question over here.
If you can hold on until we get the microphone.
My name is George Pantos. I'm a director of the Healthcare Performance Management Institute, which is a nonprofit think tank formed by some companies, including Lockheed and IBM. And we're looking at ways in which business principles and management technology can be applied to the healthcare problem, focused primarily on cost and on better quality. And I noticed in the discussion this morning that a great focus here of the exchange of information that you've been talking about, which I commend you, has been focused on the treatment aspect of the interchange of information between providers and the patient. I wanted to add another thought to the discussion, which would be to consider the exchange of information at the organizational level, which is mentioned in your paper, which talks about that as a goal, and in which the exchange of information is between the payer, which is approximately 70% of the amount in the private sector coverage, and the employee. In the workforce context, the exchange of information, and again, to add a dimension, focused not on treatment but on prevention, because the prevention aspect, studies have shown that prevention is a significant factor in the ability to control costs by identifying high risk before it occurs and applying tested wellness, care management, and other principles to dealing with the issue of prevention rather than dealing with illnesses after they occur, which are very costly. And we know the chronic conditions account for some 80% of these costs. So how do we avoid those chronic conditions as a part of the dialogue? And my question really is the government, and I take it your focus has been on standards and incentives as the government role, but you haven't discussed the link-up between those and what the private sector can be doing to utilize some of the thinking in the government with the incentives that need to be applied so that the business sector can apply the same technology that it uses in performance management, which deals with talent management and deals with such things as inventory control. I mean, Walmart knows at any particular time where all their inventory is, so that's a pretty complex system. Why can't we apply the same principles of business, private sector technology, to the solution of this very complex healthcare problem? Thank you.
So that's a great point. A lot of resources exist now for payers to be able to communicate with their subscribers. I will not name my healthcare organization, but they've been working hard over the past couple years to try to push information to me and make sure I've got my information. It's a little, you know, part of the reason I'm not going to name it is I'm about to say it, it's a little kludgy. I'm a little technologically sophisticated, which is okay, but for my family members that are not as sophisticated, it's not necessarily what they need and the way they need it. So this came up earlier, actually, talking about getting information to people, involving patients in their care and getting them the information they need. It is an open question about what's the best information to get people and what way do they need it. And when do they need it so that it makes the biggest difference in them? And prevention is absolutely, believe me, I'm with you, where you want to get them before they get sick. It's a research question for us. Right now we have an open funding opportunity saying, what information do healthcare consumers need? When do they need it? Where do they need it? How do they need it? And we're hoping over the next couple of years to get you some good answers to that. So it's a great point.
Janet?
Actually, Governor John Engler, who heads the Business Roundtable, is an enormous advocate for consumer access to information electronically and rewarding providers who coordinate care. There are a number of ways that your members can take steps forward. In fact, IBM, through its benefit design and rewarding more, reducing copays or eliminating them for preventive care has been very positive. But also, just again, through benefit design, rewarding your employees when they use tracking tools and electronic tools to improve their health and wellness, and then also even highlighting, working with your plans and highlighting those doctors or hospitals that are meaningful users or engaging in coordination of care and engaging with their patients are some quick ways. But there's a great, great opportunity here to leverage the business community. They've been a little quiet here in the last 3 or 4 years, and there's just so much value for America's employers to invest in some of these tools and in exchange.
Claudia?
So there are many rich layers to that discussion that I think Janet's hit on. I want to highlight one particular opportunity. So in September, we convened a group of many different kinds of folks on national health plans, national professional societies, local exchanges, provider groups, for an effort that we call the Consumer Pledge effort. And it's basically to say, how can we make progress this year on getting electronic health information in the hands of patients? And there's a very interesting, simple thing that I think health plans could do, which is, I don't know how many of you have heard of the Blue Button effort, but it was launched by the VA to give vets a simple way to download their information from the VA system. It's now been adopted by many, many organizations, and in fact, we just saw the federal employee health benefits plans agreeing to Blue Button employee health information that would be helped by health plans across the nation. So a simple thing would be to say, you know, those crazy EOB forms you get in paper and you can't track and think of, like, is this right? Is this not right? What if those were all electronic? And what if you then had a tool to download them, let's say, to your Health Vault account or some other PHR, and could combine that with the actual clinical data you're getting to track whether there are billing errors? We know that there are billing errors at least, I think some estimates show, about a quarter of the time or more. So there might be some simple steps we could take over the next year to tackle the things Janet talked about broadly, but just some simple things you could do to say, you can get it today, use it electronically. We need consumers not only to be improving their health, but also to be tracking billing errors, which often create overpayments and waste in the healthcare system.
Yeah, I find both my health plan and my pharmacy benefits manager are pushing prevention information to me based on what they know about me. Now, some, I have to be logged in, and I have to be, you know, it has to be me. They have to feel confident that they're talking to me. But I think you'll see that. And also the employers have been pushing. And I think Whole Foods has a great talk they give about their incentives for employees. And there are a couple of inspirational stories. I think employers have a big role to play in pushing prevention awareness. So.
Yeah, my providers keep pushing prevention information to me, and I keep
ignoring it. Human nature is the other problem. Yeah.
Okay, we have time just for a couple more questions. We'll go right there on the end.
Hi, Jeff Coughlin from Marwood Group. Thanks so much for this session. It's been a very interesting discussion, and I look forward to reading the report. One question I had in the course of your research, whether what the breakdown was between HIE systems that were vendor-driven and others that were homegrown, created homegrown systems. So I'm just curious whether it's even possible to create an HIE without, you know, absent a vendor involvement.
I think most of them are homegrown, if I understand the way that you mean the term, in the sense that, you know, there have been a variety of local and regional HIEs that have been in existence for a number of years. And so, you know, with the state effort to try and impose a little order and connectivity on that, it was building on efforts that already had started in hospitals, healthcare providers, and physician organizations.
I think we see a little bit of both. For instance, Indiana's really built their own, but for the most of the other examples here, they've relied on vendors as key partners. So I think we see a little bit of both. I believe in a lot of the ACO-driven HIE efforts, they're putting out RFPs and they're hiring folks, whether they're EHR vendor or HIE-focused vendor, to drive the implementation. So I'd say generally we probably see more examples where there's a key vendor IT partner. We have a few like Indiana let's remember that they came up with LOINC, right? These guys are at the bleeding edge of a lot of technology development, but I think they're a little bit unique.
I was just looking for the data points. There was a survey somewhere that tracked, was it CLASS?
Yeah, CLASS.
That tracked both the public, sort of publicly funded systems and the private sector systems, and this relates to Joel's question earlier around consolidation, I think. We're seeing a big uptick, and although it's not really apparent, but it's happening across the country around networks, private networks being built to address this. And I'm hopeful that some of the, you know, policy changes will help assure that data flows so one can get to coordinated high-quality care without having to merge. I think Health IT, I'm sort of switched subjects on you, but Health IT offers the capability for even small physician practices, less sophisticated systems to achieve many of the attributes of more coordinated, accountable care.
Okay, we'll take time for one more question right here on the front row.
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. Most of the discussion is focused on the use of HIT for coordination within a provider system or between a provider and a consumer. But the question that was asked here stimulated a thought in my mind which I have not heard addressed, but is very relevant to bridging gaps between medical care and public health. And that is, what are the implications of using health information technology to clarify inefficiencies in the system at a geographical level, not at a provider level, but within the neighborhood or within a geographical level, so that the fragmentation, which we often criticize but hold on to because it's profitable, but that fragmentation needs to be chipped away at, overcome, and overcome in a way that permits a redirection of inefficiencies. So savings, let's say, in healthcare could be reallocated to the public health issues that are often associated with prevention. Has there been any thinking of how this kind of information system could be of use in community health planning purposes?
Great closing question. Jenna?
Would we talk to high-performing organizations across the country, particularly one in Minnesota comes to mind, and some others? We talk, and Daryl's report talks about the use of administrative and clinical information, but more and more, just as you say, you know, accessing patient-generated information and even community health information can help to identify where there are issues, so combinations of that data. There's a wonderful little organization in Austin, Texas, that actually identifies, I can't remember their name, hot spots based on, you know, where there are higher levels of obesity, and then they correlate it with other community data sets to figure out, you know, how do we address this problem? And so much of it is outside of the healthcare system, as you mentioned. And I think they ended up adding some classes and even exercise equipment within some of the schools to address the problem. So that's a wonderful area for research and more movement. And health plans and employers and government have great interest in that.
Claudia?
So I was doing some thinking yesterday about all payer claims databases, which are being pursued in 27 states, and trying to do a little blue sky thinking, not knowing a lot about how could you open up that as a data source that could be used. If you think about Todd Park's Community Health Data Initiative, where you're basically taking these incredible stores of information and making them more useful to all kinds of folks, whether community health planners or community health centers or crime prevention people, to use those data for their own purposes. But DC, when Vivek Kundra was here, had, I don't know, like 100 data feeds from various data sources. So I think we have some real opportunities to link HIE data and some of these all payer claims database data, but also increasingly to make data feeds of those data available to the public, because I think it often won't just be the government planners, but frankly, the community watchdog group and the diabetes prevention organization and the health plan that want to use those data to analyze and figure out what they're going to do. So I know one of the things that we've been, some of states are actually putting out challenges to see if they can create API feeds of HIE data, to, you know, aggregated, that might be combined with other public health data sources. So I think we're going to see a lot of innovation in this area if we can make those data more liquid and more available to a broad range of users.
There is a, I think, a very relevant program at ONC, the Pop Health tool that can be bolted onto EHRs. It's an open source product that ONC sponsors. And MITRE developed. My colleague Lisa Tutterow here can tell you more about that if you have any interest. But it's a freely available tool. And the thing about it is it aggregates quality measure data right now currently from stage one. It'll grow with the program over time. And so if, for example, a smoker, how many smokers in a given physician's population or organization's population have not received smoking cessation counseling, for example? How many patients are obese? You can have, and it's actually designed to remove identifying information so that it can be used for public health purposes without a HIPAA problem or anything. So that's one of the things that's going on. The other thing is there's now a joint public health IT working group that will be meeting at HIMSS in Las Vegas in about 2 weeks. So Seth Volvey from CDC has been very active with that group, Bill Hacker from Kentucky, a number of state public health and local public health officials participate in that. We've been able to work with them on thinking about how do you do the kinds of things you're saying, because there was an interesting forum on Capitol Hill where we talked about how all this investment in EHRs can be leveraged for public health, and it wouldn't take very much effort to make that happen. So it's a really good point.
So, John, we'll give you the last words. It needs to be brilliant and insightful.
Brief and brilliant. I think we're on the cusp of a lot of exciting things. I think that healthcare has tremendous potential to learn from other industries that have done this and combine information in ways that are really kind of cool, and you can do really cool things with that you couldn't do with it before. I want to pair that with and come back to this fundamental issue of trust that has come up again and again. it's just not the same as, you know, what I buy at Target versus, you know, what my CBC is and, you know, what my HIV status is. It's there are different types of information, and we have different expectations around that. So can we go there? Yeah. Should we go there? We need to talk about that, and we need to come to a shared understanding before we do go there, and you know, everybody gets really excited about it.
Okay, great discussion. I want to thank John, Claudia, John, and Janet for sharing your thoughts with us.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for coming out.